Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton, Chief Futurist at ARK Invest. With me, I have Nemo. Nemo is our multiomics extraordinaire. Today, who are we talking to, Nemo?
So today we are talking with Professor Thomas Harton, who is MD, PhD. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Witten School of Engineering of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., as well as University of Konstanz in Germany. And he directs the Center for Alternative Animal Testing in the U.S. and Europe, and currently serves on the organizing committee on the Exposome Moonshot Forum, a multinational initiative aligning industry, government, and academia to basically quantify rapidly changing environment and effects on the human health. He is also serves as a field chief editor of Frontiers in AI, and he has authored more than 700 publications with 50,000 plus citations.
So most of his work seems to kind of center on this idea, or a lot of his work centers on this idea that you can create basically like little organ proxies, little organs on chips, call it, that allow you to do lots of drug testing without having to instead, you know, test on mice and stuff like that. What would this mean for kind of the economics of drug development?
Yeah, so I think the kind of where he basically starts is like, you know, reimagining how the toxicology and the safety studies could be done. And the biggest issue today is that we use animal models before we're going to go to clinical trials. And, you know, animal models, there's certain benefits, but there's many more kind of issues with them. And we can see that with the drug discovery cost and failures of the drug discovery. So basically using kind of human models is much more closer to actually the humans that will be receiving the drug. And then also basically kind of with this kind of with organoids or organs or chips, we have so much better kind of physiological model, which is a human-like. The cost is significantly going down. The throughput and scale of these models is much better than the animal models. So we are basically getting better, cheaper, faster, which is the kind of story of the AI in drug discovery that we're seeing. And then if we just couple this with AI, there's a convergence of technologies and kind of compounding effect. So much, much faster the drugs to the market, which are probably much more safe and actually much more precise.
Yeah. And one of the things that it comes up in the discussion that I think is interesting about this is, you know, we're able to do this because we understand how to manipulate stem cells now. We have better microfluidic technology, and there's just lots of good engineering we've done to create these little organoids. So you can create three-dimensional structures as opposed to two-dimensional. Biopharma begins using them and says, hey, this is a way that we can get to market quicker and spend less money to get to market, then that will drive continued engineering advances. And so then these models will get even better. In some ways, it's a little bizarre that, the drug I'm going to take because I have a human disease is first screened through a mouse, which, you know, may not identify things in the drug because a mouse isn't a human, and it may identify problems with the drug that actually don't exist in humans, but they exist in mice.
Yeah, so my PhD was kind of mix of the genomics, cancer, biology, and there's one saying in cancer kind of biology world, like cancer has been cured 1,000 times in mice, you know? It's a so much different system. So that's one option. And then the other option is like the kind of 2D cancer cell lines, which is extremely superficial and not really physiological. So organoids, organs or chips are the right medium for us to do this. And for me, it's not the question, will biopharma do this? It's just understanding how fast they will get there. And we already know that there are some kind of big pharma companies and even some smaller kind of biotech companies which are paving this way. We also know that on the private side, there's a quite a few companies which are actually developing these organs and organs and chips as the products. So it's brewing. It's just a question of understanding the right timeline, which I think is going to be sooner than later, but I'm always too optimistic.
Yes. And so then the kind of final stage of the discussion, just to preview it, is we get into, hey, if you have a bunch of organoids that are kind of brain organoids, what other uses could they have outside of even biology? Can we use these as sensors? Can we use these as computers? Talk about disruptive technology. I personally am not sure I'm comfortable with having like a little piece of brain up in the wall to you know, drive my, I don't know, smart thermostat, but I guess we will see.
Yeah. So I think the kind of key point here is that, you know, brain organoids as our brain as well, you know, they're much actually faster. They need much energy to actually do very kind of difficult compute. And it would be more kind of complementary to the existing kind of compute methods, but that's the kind of ultimate, maybe long-term application where this could go. In the meantime, you know, we could basically first use these kind of organoids to learn how they are learning and actually doing the kind of biological compute, so we can actually create better algorithms for the current kind of system that we have. But I do think that eventually we are going to have a biological compute happening. Not sure when. And I know we have this, you know, quantum versus this, but, you know, this will happen. Because when you just compare how fast and how much little energy they need to do and how much we can grow them, you know, it could be really disruptive force ahead.
Yes. Well, it would certainly be a different way to run computation. That's for sure. Or maybe actually just the way we are now. It's just we're doing it inside our heads. Let's do it, you know, somewhere else. So enjoy the conversation with Professor Hartung. It's really kind of fascinating and covers a lot of different terrain. And thanks for joining us.
Hi, and welcome for Your Innovation podcast by ARC. Today, I'm joined with my colleague, Brett Winton, and Professor Thomas Hartung, who is a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and as well a professor of the engineering in Winton School of Engineering in Georgetown and in professor in Germany at University of Konstanz. So welcome, Professor Hartung. So maybe where we could kind of kick it off and just talk to us about, in our audience, about current issues with kind of preclinical testing in drug discovery. We know that that's the field that they have been for many years kind of spearheading the research efforts. And so what are some of the issues that we have and why so many drugs actually failing, and how can we make the preclinical actually studies much more efficient?
Thanks for having me, and happy to talk a bit about my favorite subject, which is the shortcomings of animal testing and why we need new technologies. In the life sciences, for many decades, since, let's say, the 1920s, when animal testing really starts to take off, when lab rats suddenly became a commodity and everybody was using them, and mice a little bit later on, there was nothing else. Cell culture came only in the 60s, really, 70s more relevantly. Computers, I would say, they are now there that they can really deliver a lot. So we were forced to use animals if we wanted new drugs, if we wanted to have insights into biology, and everybody was using them. Actually, we have come already quite a bit down. In the late 70s was probably the peak for the few countries where we have data. It shows that we probably used 3 times more animals than we use now in these countries. So by finding other ways of testing, we have already come a far way, but it is really only over the last 10, 20 years that we learned there's good reason to move away, because these animal tests have sometimes more shortcomings than we believe, not just ethically or acceptance by our customers and society, there's really good reason to do something different.
I think in 2009, you published a paper around this is how toxicology testing needs to change or will change. What has changed relative to 2009 even, and what are the tools that we're using now, and where is the pace of progress kind of most rapid?
And in 2009, we really started to understand shortcomings of the animal tests, what the wrong decisions we are taking also in drug development. But we really only started to get the tools, the real tools, into our hands. Since then, we have seen the advent of artificial intelligence, which is impacting every aspect of science. Yeah. And from my point of view, and I'm a very, very strong advocate for this, they're actually already outperforming the traditional tools. But we need to build trust. We don't want to rush into something which could endanger people. Yeah. However, we also got through engineering what we now call microphysiological systems. So these are systems where we not just keep cell alive, which we did in the past. They are in a petri dish and look like a pan-fried egg sunny side up. And we just kept them living. We pampered them. But now we're coming to something where we are recreating aspects of organs, organ architecture, organ functionality. In a very small setup, that's why we call them micro, but they're physiological, they're exerting certain functions. And these type of systems are largely enabled because we have stem cell technologies. And this is, by scientific standards, a very recent development. Human stem cells were invented in 1999, but these came from no longer needed in vitro fertilization embryos and had a lot of ethical constraints that people said, you cannot use them freely, easily. Funding bodies did not want to give money for this or only under very, very restricted circumstances. And then in 2006, Yamanaka published how we can produce something very, very similar to an embryonic stem cell by taking skin cells and reprogramming them. This was one of the fastest Nobel Prizes. In 2012, we got a Nobel Prize because it is such an enabling step for all of biomedical research. And it has now, in consequence from this development, not even 20 years ago, we get more and more models, better and better for each and every organ. We can do them from patients from different ethnic backgrounds. It was really a very enabling technology.
I can totally understand how that would be useful. Like, you can do much larger parallel experiments if you just have like little dishes with things. You can probably do experiments faster than you would be able to do if you have to have, you know, big cages with lots of lab mice in them and with AI, it's important to gather as much data as possible. I mean, probably even the utility of the data you get off these systems is much higher. Is it happening like widespread now, or are there organs that are off limits? Is there like, why aren't we doing this like at huge scale already, or are we? And I'm just ignorant.
We are doing. Science is really moving into this. But as everything, it takes time. If there's a researcher who has worked his entire scientific life on a certain animal model, it will take quite a while to make them change. Not only because they are scientifically narrow or so, it is often just they have a team, they have people, and these people are trained on keeping rats or non-human primates or whatever, and to change the methodology would mean to lay them off. So it's very often only with a generation change, the next professor coming in and changing the spin of the department, that these changes take place. That's not scientifically justified, but it is justified just because we are social animals and we take care of our people. And I will always find the next project I can do again on an animal model.
Maybe just to kind of follow up on the kind of these new tools development, kind of my understanding that there are kind of three different important things that happen. So kind of really being able to go from the 2D to 3D and kind of, you know, not have only kind of flat cells, but actually trying to kind of mimic organs. And then the one thing that you're saying, the stem cells is the second one. And then third is like a kind of microfluidics approaches, which basically kind of enable us to kind of have this, you know, organs on chips or however you call them. Is this the right kind of framework for us to understand what kind of innovation was driving expansion of this space?
Yeah, you have already listed quite a few of the changes which take place in parallel. Say this bioengineering, which in, for these microphysiological systems, not just about 3D. 3D is one aspect. We are not flat Stanleys. We are three-dimensional, and a lot of the function of an organ is only possible by this third-dimensional arrangement. But it is also each and every organ is made up of tons of different cell types. If you take a lung, it's more than 40 different cell types. So you really have need them all for organ functionality. So cell culture has been for many, many years just getting single cell type, study the single cell type, and now, okay, but this is not organ functionality. And we also have been using far too long cancer cell lines. Cancer cell lines was a way of maintaining them. But it's not only about the different cell types and three-dimensional. It is also about perfusion. Like an organ is perfused by blood, microfluidics, which you mentioned, is maintaining the supply with oxygen and nutrients of the cells and keeping them under homeostatic conditions. So they have always the same environment, just like in the body. Traditional cell culture, you add fresh cell culture media, and then they have plenty of everything. And then over the next 2 days or so, they consume it, and waste accumulates. And then within a second, the entire environment changes again when we change the media. And this is something which really is completely unphysiological and forces the cells to a type of flexibility which is it is hindering them to really differentiate and show a functionality as we would like to see them.
So maybe the follow-up question, you know, when you think about all these kind of pharma companies which are doing drug discovery, I mean, they do so much screening in these, you know, some kind of cell cancer cell lines, right? I mean, all of that data could be seen almost as a waste because, you know, they are screening this in such a non-physiological kind of conditions. Sure, there is some usefulness, but, you know, how do we move from there that actually the drug discovery is being done completely on these kind of organoids or organs or chips kind of systems? And where are we in that move?
Developing a drug is a, on average, 12-year process. And we used to say that you need to test about 10,000 chemicals to end up with one which can go to the market. Only 10 of the 10,000 go into clinical trials. That's more or less the funnel of things you want. And this process of 12 years is really costly. It costs more than $2 billion on average to run this. It's not one test. In the 70s, the companies would literally run 10,000 chemicals in animal models. And this is why we've used so many animals at the time. Nowadays, you start with simple systems to narrow down to promising candidates. And these can be cancer cell lines, yeah? If you, for example, want something which is triggering a certain receptor on cells, it is sufficient that your cancer cell line has this receptor. Einstein said, make things as simple as possible, but not simpler. So it really depends on where you are in the process. Later on, you want more complex systems, which tell you much more about how it is changing function, not just it binds to a receptor. Yeah? And then you need the more complex systems. And this is the step for the pharma companies now from early discovery, which is hits, to something which is a candidate where you have already optimized it. That's where these systems come into play. And then you start looking into disease models. That's where animal models still play a role, but they're very, very late in the process. And this new approach promises to shorten dramatically the development time. And by the way, one day earlier on the market is worth about $1 million for a pharmaceutical company. Because they have about, on average, about 8 years under patent when they still can sell exclusively their stuff. So it's at least $1 million worth if you just want to recover the costs of development.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely speaking our language there, as in we've done modeling on kind of like AI's impact on drug discovery, and the ability to shorten time to market is a meaningful contributor to kind of our expectations for return on R&D, because you go through that negative cash flow period more quickly and, you know, probably less expensively, but even just getting through more quickly, then you have a longer life that you can monetize the drug before you're facing competitive pressure.
Same page here. And, you know, the interesting thing of the pandemic was that we saw that we can dramatically shorten development times by essentially skipping the animal development phase. Vaccines are not much different to small molecule drugs or biologicals. Their development is on average 10.6 years with 6% success rate. What have we seen in the pandemic? Essentially without animal tests, a few safety tests have been done, but we had 9 successful vaccines within 1 year. This is unheard of. And we had in 1.5 years, 2 antivirals on the market, which were also, again, done essentially without animal tests. We know this for the Moderna vaccine, for example. The sequence of the virus was released by the Chinese mid-January of 2020. They injected the first patient with the vaccine in mid-March, 2 months later. And the only animal experiment which took place, they injected into mice to see whether the mouse builds some antibodies against this. But all these typical phases of optimization and so on in animal tests, they were just skipped. And this is very promising from my point of view for rethinking what we can do differently and faster and in a more parallel approach.
Those were special regulatory circumstances. If I were a drug developer today and I was like, do you know what? I'm going straight to phase 1 clinical trial because I think this is things going to work. I'm sure the FDA would be like, whoa, yeah, right? Like, isn't there a regulatory constraint to prevent us from going in that way? I mean, I can understand, like, I totally would advocate for, you know, let these companies move faster. I wonder if the regulatory apparatus would feel the same.
Hey, actually, they understand that they have to embrace the new stuff. There's different reasons for this. About half of the new drugs are actually human proteins or antibodies against human structures, which are useless to test in animals, safety-wise. And so this is already 50% of the drugs, yeah, where you need different systems, which are all faster than the animal test. Yeah. And also for the rest, we are learning more and more how little predictive they are. Pharma companies have done 2 big studies jointly, where some 15, 20 companies each have analyzed their data, and they asked how much of the side effects in humans, which we saw later in the clinical trials, could have been predicted from rodents. And it was about 43%. Yeah? The rest is not seen. So alone from these things, we should be wide, wide open for different type of approaches nowadays. But we need to build trust. We need to. We don't want to endanger a single human volunteer getting the first injection or the first patient seeing something. But for example, the FDA has signed with us a research collaboration agreement in spring last year to do exactly this, to build trust in the new methods and train their staff on new methodologies because they understand this is necessary. And I tell you, if the FDA does it, everybody does it. It's very simple. We in the US are 4% of the world population, but we are 48% of the drug market and 64% of the drug market under patent. So it is the only measure is the FDA allowing this? Are they interested in this approach? And this is why it has such a lead role. Yeah.
Just two kind of follow-ups there. I think last year or maybe 2 years ago, FDA also did kind of change that for this kind of IND enabling studies, you can now use kind of organoids and similar kind of data actually, right? Which I saw as a kind of positive side for them, kind of understanding that this is needed. And so how do you think about the new FDA now that's going to be, I mean, with the new administration, do you think that the kind of progress could be even faster in kind of bringing this? Or this is really just, it's going to take time just to build this trust that you're mentioning, and we can't kind of change that. But I'm trying to understand, like, how quickly do you think we can come to this stage, like Moderna and those, you know, were developing vaccines, that we could be developing all the drugs?
I mean, first we should say this legislation, which was signed by Biden in December 2022, FDA Modernization Act, as they called it, did not really change anything legally. You could have used these methods before, but it was a very important signal. It was a signal by policymakers, especially since it was really passing unanimously, which is a very rare thing in the US. Yeah. It really passed and gave a signal. We policymakers want new regulators to consider these new methodologies. It was a very important signal to the regulated industry that this is welcome. And it was a very important signal to the biotech industry. There's a market. There's something where you really can sell your stuff now. And this has really given a big push, yeah, without changing dramatically legislation. Yeah? I think this was really important. And I've seen that the FDA is changing. The research collaboration agreement was possible because the FDA knocked on our doors, not us knocking on FDA doors. And imagine this, yeah? This is an agency of 19,000 people, and they come to a research group in Hopkins and say, the Center for Autologous Animal Testing, say, you guys can help us to build trust in these methods, yeah? So I said, this was my Christmas present, more or less, yeah? Even though it came in April.
And so from there, I mean, I think it's just to pull on a thread that you just mentioned, there is a way in which these kinds of transitions can become self-fulfilling and self-accelerating, as in if there's a strong signal from the market, hey, this is a way you can do things, then that encourages vendors and scientists and, you know, businesses to kind of like both demonstrate that it works and push capital into providing kind of like an acceleration and capability of kind of like how functional are the organoids and like what kind of tooling do we need to build and maintain them, and then whatever efficacy advantage organoids have over animal testing actually extends, and so then it becomes even more obvious that it's the right way to go. Where are we? One, do you agree with that kind of laying out of how things could occur? And then where do you feel we are in the process of that happening? Are we very early, or is this kind of, hey, this is already happening and it's accelerating away? Like, where are we in terms of practical like implementation here?
I see that the most progressive companies are broadly using this. Companies like Roche, AstraZeneca, Sanofi, they're using these type of approaches. Roche has created an Institute for Human Biology, which is only dedicated to these type of systems on their campus, and they have more than 400 employees in this. So they really invest big. They have already had, they say, they didn't publish this really properly, but they say they had at least 8 cases where they used findings from these systems with their registration processes. Sanofi succeeded together with Hesperos, one of these microphysiology system companies, in 2022 to move first time into humans for a new indication with a drug without any animal data. It was the first. There's something happening, yeah. And I'm working very closely with AstraZeneca and also one of the companies really. Pushing the limits of these type of tests very much so. And all the others see they're missing something. we started a series of world summits in this field. We are now organizing in Brussels next June the fourth one of these, and created an international society which is now taking over the series of conferences. But it is really something which has a lot of excitement, because most of drug development is a competition of ideas. If you have something which is a little bit better, better predictive, if it is a bit faster, you can have an edge over the competition. It is different for safety. In safety, you need consensus with the regulators. So this is a bit of a different beast. Yeah.
I mean, I guess if we're in some cases able to skip preclinical testing, call it now with drugs in pipeline, we still wouldn't see kind of those commercialized until, 6 or 8 years after that, right? Like, as in, one of the interesting things that for us, as in, we have a differentiated point of view on what return on R&D for these companies using these techniques is going to turn out to be. But there's a pretty long time gap between when they're doing the thing that's smart and you actually recognize that, hey, here's an approved drug that they didn't spend $2 billion on. They spent $800 million, including cost of failure, to get it to market. And so in some ways it's frustrating. It's like, hey, I think there's like, the sparks of something that is actually going to be very, business, monetizable here. And kind of Wall Street is like, well, show me the money.
No, there's a delay. This is particular about the drug development market, that it takes on average 12 years to get to the market. Yeah. And only with the successful projects. And there are many are sorted out before and abandoned after considerable costs. Yeah, but while I cannot really deliver you a lot of hard facts for the microphysiological system side of things, yeah, I can only tell you there's excitement and we feel it in these conferences. Yeah, the other technology which is really disruptive at the moment is AI. And most people have only noticed AI with the advent of the large language models, the chatbots in 2023, but they came out in November, December 2022. Yeah, but AI has been embraced by the pharmaceutical industry much earlier, and I would say roughly meaningful contributions have been made since 2019. But in 2022, we had already 18 drugs which were AI first. So they were generated with AI. Imagine, in 3 years, they have, which were entering clinical trials, 18. That's unheard of. The most successful one by InSilico Medicine already entered a phase 2 study last year. No, last year, 2023. I always forget that we're already in 2025. And they completed phase 2A in fall of 2024 and entered the phase 2B testing, from my understanding now. So this is really remarkable. Yeah? Such a fast development. Imagine from 2019, essentially, when they stopped their projects, to a clinical phase 2B, in just 5 years, that's something a lot of companies would dream of.
And the two technologies compound, which I think is interesting. As in, or if you have good organoids, it means that you can generate good data for an AI system that then could also train the AI system to be better at understanding kind of what's going on, kind of biologically.
Yeah, no, that's the point. We have a lot of disruptive technologies at the same time. These biological test systems are one thing, but you also have the analytical and sensor technologies which are exploding. We can get big data from these systems, and then the throughput is incredible. I'm interested in brain. We can talk about this field in a second, but we are producing tens of thousands of brain organoids from humans in a highly standardized way per week. Yeah. And each of them could replace an animal. But we also have the technologies to get thousands of data points from each of these brain organoids. And AI is helping us to make sense of these. So we really have a synergy of several exponentially growing technologies. And most people cannot grasp how much this is changing biomedical research or drug development.
Yeah. Okay. So let's extend into the brain piece. What are you doing with your tens of thousands of brain organoids? Are you building a brain army back in your garage that's going to...
My garage in Johns Hopkins, yeah. The opportunity really is in producing functional units of a human brain, and you can imagine there's not really a lot of models available which are human, and we are very different in our brain even to monkeys, like non-human primates, macaques, yeah. But if I want to pick your brain and not in a just literal sense and say, what about a little donation for my research? Most people are relatively hesitant, yeah, and for good reason. And what I can get as human material is tiny little amounts and not on a regular basis, because organ donations are when people are brain dead, so I cannot work with it anymore. The tiny amounts from surgery, fighting with the pathologist who gets how much, is not really a solution. So it was really only with the possibility to create brain organoids, which is was first described in 2013. We were actually the same year producing our first manuscript on them, but we were only the second or third group. But 3 years later, we were the first to mass produce them and publish this. And I can produce in one of these tiny little six well plates about 4,000 brain organoids, less than a cent per brain organoid. Compare this to a rat, which is $30 to $40 piece. Yeah, and we have a human system. And our interest in this came originally from autism, which is a big, big problem, bigger than most people realize. Autism was something really rare in the 70s. One in 10,000 children was diagnosed. Last data by the Center for Disease Control in the US says one in 36 children is now diagnosed with autism by the age of 8. And trying to find systems which are helping us to identify the lifestyle factors, the chemicals which are contributing to this, because genetics cannot explain this, yeah? We were looking for meaningful systems, and that's why we were pushing for the brain organoid development. But once we had the brain organoids, we're using it for all types of diseases, on Alzheimer, on amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. We used them in COVID to show that we were the first to show that the virus is infecting human brain cells, because we had the model available, and it was easy peasy to just try it, yeah.
So maybe just a follow-up question there, if I'm understanding this right, kind of when we think about kind of organoids approach, it's really increasing the scale and the throughput. It's a human system. It reduces the cost. And I assume it also gives you much bigger diversity, because you can have many different patients from many different patients' organoids, right? Am I missing any of the kind of positive sides versus the kind of current animal that we use in the testing?
Many pharma companies see them at the moment as a step in between their higher throughput testing in cell lines before they move into animals. But increasingly, some companies say it's not really before the animal. It is at least in parallel or even just circumventing the animal test. Because why should I, after have a human effective mechanism, why should I go back to an animal model? It really depends on how much you trust the models, how much you can validate what they're saying, or whether you want to play it conservative or more progressive. In many instances, there is not even an animal model. As I said, 50% of drugs are now proteins or antibodies. They make no sense in any animal model. You can only waste time on it, yeah. And this is why they are expanding in their use. But this is also a matter of building trust and understanding what are, is the registration package which is expected in order to get my IND, so going first into humans or later for registration. What so yeah, some animal models are done just to check the boxes, yeah, and not be sent home, go back and bring us these data.
And then what are the kind of, from your perspective, still big hurdles in the kind of organoid / organs on chips kind of research that needs to be solved? You know, or like what, like, are we trying still to push the cost, high throughput? Are we really trying to kind of converge organoids with AI where I'm kind of doing the testing and then I'm using AI to analyze the data? Like, where are the kind of frontiers that you see now in the research that are happening?
There's a couple of frontiers. One is really in combining organs. There's systems, but they're pretty sophisticated, and you need to have the expertise for the different organs and be able to also coordinate that they're mature at the right stage at the right moment. And the more organs you put together, the more difficult this is. The second thing which most of these models are lacking at the moment is an immune system. And there's not really a lot of diseases which do not involve some inflammation. So there's a there's something here. And I also would say that the microfluidics, which is really necessary for homeostasis, is still a challenge to really get the compartments right, the flows. But I would say these are all engineering challenges. They're not really rocket science. You don't need to have a completely new concept. You just have to optimize these systems. And with more market, there's companies stepping in to produce exactly these systems. Yeah, they build the plug-and-play components. They have the integrated systems where you that everything is maintained and monitored, and you just have to inject your substance of interest and get the results out. Yeah,
it seems like having 10,000 brains produced a week, not brains, but organoid brains, those could be useful even outside of the direct biological testing context, or at least you've asserted such. Can you talk about like using these for potential sensors or for pattern recognition or even for like some kind of like substrate of a new compute?
The goal of these microphysiological systems is not only to produce the architecture, but also the functionality of an organ. So if you look into the functionality of a brain, it is obviously cognition. It is about memory and learning, something which sounds bizarre or science fiction to think about a cell culture which could learn and memorize. Yeah? But that's exactly what we are trying to do. During the pandemic, my wife, Lena Smirnova, and me, we were sitting here and she was running our brain organoid work, and I have focused mostly on AI over the last 10 years. And we said, what can we do together? There's now people using AI to talk to whales and or other animals. Can't we talk to brain organoids? And out of this idea, we developed the concept of organoid intelligence, OI, saying we should be able to provoke the brain to do something meaningful. And if you think through, we are boring our brain cells to death. They're really longing to get some input. They talk to each other spontaneously, but they have no input and no output. And so what we are doing is really we're giving them input and output. And we very early on teamed up with Cortical Labs in Australia. These guys were the first to let a brain cell culture play a computer game, Pong. And we were already working with them for a year, and we wrote the editorial for their publication when this came out in December of 2022. And they are part of our publications on organoid intelligence, which came out in February of 2023. And this was really a splash together, especially. Yep. They have a very simple implementation. And since then, we are using computer games of different kind, and we are trying to show that our systems can learn and We're trying to build a complex in vitro system of learning and memory. Some people call this embodied intelligence. Yeah? It is really trying to make such a system available, first of all, to understand the biology of learning. But then for me as a pharmacologist and toxicologist, it is also, can I build a disease model? And can I show that the drug is changing this? Yeah. And so we are trying to do this with cells from patients. We are trying to introduce certain diseases in our model and hope that we can benchmark their learning and how this is impacted by external substances.
It would seem like there's the potential for, I mean, you know, we look at all kinds of different disruptive technologies. I would definitely classify this as potentially disruptive. You know, even in the AI space, we've talked to companies where, you know, their theory of the case is actually you need these AI systems to be much smaller than we're building and then to grow kind of in the local environment. So you can imagine like even kind of like some kind of, what's the computer behind a sensor? Then the sensor is supposed to, you know, detect toxicology or something. You could imagine that computer needs to in some way grow and integrate what's the normal kind of environment that that sensor lives in so it can identify more efficiently like the foreign substance that has been introduced. Is that like, is that science fiction or is that the kind of like practical non-biology application that, that these kind of organoids could go into, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to understand that the brain is a fantastic supercomputer. This is something most people are not aware of. These 1.4 kilogram of brain we are wearing on our shoulders outperforms almost every computer. The computational capacity has been estimated at 1 exaflop. This was reached by the leading supercomputer only in June of 2022. The Frontier computer in Kentucky outperformed 1 exaflop. And this was an installation on 6,800 square feet for $600 million. Yeah? And that's what we're having on our shoulders. And also, I mean, we have about 2.5 petabyte of memory. This is 2,500 hard disks of 1 terabyte, yeah? This, we're really pretty good in these things. And some things we can simply do are better than a top computer. So for example, if you ask, show a child 10 pictures of a horse and a donkey or you show zebras, 10 pictures are sufficient to build categories of these. And then you, a computer needs several hundred to do this with the same accuracy. And you can show the child then a single picture of a unicorn, and it gets the concept, and this single picture is sufficient now to categorize unicorns. The computer needs some 1,000 pictures, 100 pictures at least, again, to make this distinction. Or another example, our brain can continuously learn. If I learn today a few new words in Italian, I integrate this into my language. Our algorithms have to be updated, to be retrained, as we see with these large language models, where we do this more or less on an annual basis, a new retrain before it is really incorporated into knowledge. And there's also other things like intuition. We can think enormously fast if it is necessary. Where we have to wait for minutes still so that the computer has digested the information. We jump because we hear a noise in the jungle because there could be a tiger. Yeah? We get the answer by a large language model after the meal of the tiger. Yeah? So there's really a lot of things we would love to learn about the brain. And this, for me, would take, first of all, the shape of what we call neuromorphic computing. So computing where we use architecture or algorithms which are more brain-like. But some people think of biological computers. They dream of a 10-kilogram brain unit in a supercomputer, which takes certain tasks which the the in silico computer cannot do as well.
But when that dream will be feasible, do you think so?
It's difficult. I believe very much in a very short time period for making these disease models available and help drug development. I'm skeptical for the brain model in a computer, because we cannot overcome the one shortcoming of our brain. We cannot program it, and we cannot clone it. So what you have learned, you cannot just copy on another computer. So these brain computers will be develop their knowledge over longer training periods, which is not really competitive. Even if we can standardize this and accelerate this, I'm very skeptical that this is really helpful. If each computer is an individual and there will never be a second one with the same responses. But I might have not enough fantasy here.
Well, I think as with all disruptive technology, it would have to be in some kind of, like, that is what you're describing as a bug. And then in certain contexts, maybe it could be a feature, but it would require, one, the tooling and the cost declines and the understanding, but then also somebody discovering that application or figuring out how to plug into that commercially.
Yeah, no, I agree. As I said, I stay here. I like to be visionary as to the extent possible, but here I stay with the things which are close by. I think Turing said we cannot see far in the future, but in the near term, there's a lot to be done. Yeah, and
so you think quantum computing is still the path forward, not biological computing still?
I mean, sorry, I cannot compete with my handheld calculator. So I should not try to compete with the things a computer can now do better than me. And quantum computing will bring this another two log orders away from where we are now. Don't compete for this, but perhaps if you look for things like emotional intelligence, yeah, a computer can only fake it. You can only pretend to have emotions. If we find a way of teaching emotions to a biological computer, I could imagine that this is something which is helpful. I don't know how to cuddle a brain organoid, but somehow these type of experiences need to be translated. Yeah,
you're the world expert, and you haven't figured out how to cuddle one yet.
No,
but new research area.
But I could imagine more easily a model of chronic pain and suffering. Yeah. But then very quickly ethics come in, and this is something not to be underestimated. If we build a model of chronic pain with a brain organoid, which is to some extent self-aware, you have to ask yourself, when is there something we should not cross? Yeah, can we really inflict pain to such a system? Or can we really stop feeding it after a while because we say the experiment is done? If this has developed some type of self-awareness. Yeah?
I suspect we're going to have to cross similar ethical terrain within the silicon AI space, probably more quickly even than on the brain side. I mean, in some ways.
Some of the discussions. Yes.
When are we going to get to a spot where it's like rebooting the system is a form of homicide, right? You know, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of ethical unpacking and thinking about what we mean by consciousness that we're going to have to do here. And maybe the organoids could help, like maybe that's an area that could help kind of us to understand.
Actually, that's exactly the path we are moving forward. We have teamed up from the very first day of our OI work with the Berman Institute of Bioethics, and these colleagues we call them this embedded ethics. They're sitting with us and discussing our experiments on a weekly basis, and they come to the lab and see this, and they're now moving to something which they call experimental ethics. They say these type of systems could allow us to learn what does it take to call something intelligent, what components are necessary to realize this. So there's a lot of potential going into social sciences, and I'm fascinated by this. But also, I'm they are, for example, asking lay people, what do you think about this research? And when do you think it feels uncomfortable? Would you say, oof, you better don't do this? And would this change, for example, if you make clear this is done to develop a drug against Alzheimer's? So they're really trying to find out before we are there, before we run these experiments, where the general public is having a problem. And then we might take certain decisions. For example, we might want not to make a brain organoid bigger than a fetus, which we still allow to abort. This could be a reasonable measure. Yeah? You can say, okay, 16 weeks or so, that's a standard which we accept. At this stage, the brain is probably 5 millimeters, 6 millimeters, I assume. I've not really checked the textbooks here. But we could say this could be a concept, to say, yep, we don't go further.
But it seems very species-centric, as in, like, we're killing millions, probably billions of animals in animal testing along the way, right? Those brains are a lot bigger than a 16-week.
Yeah, but I mean, the ethical problems really come with the human side of things, that there's a donor behind it. Often somebody still living, somebody who consented in a certain type of experiments. And some of my colleagues said, Thomas, why don't you just use mice? It will be probably 10 years before a human brain organoid outperforms a mouse brain organoid. And then I say, look, as a pharmacologist and toxicologist, I want the human reaction. I want to replace the macaque in the basic biology question. So I really want to understand humans, and I give up a lot of opportunity here. But I'm aware that this is forcing me also to face the ethical scrutiny, and but I'm willing to do this, and I'm also willing to set these limits. If there's a consensus which says don't go above a certain size, or perhaps even don't train them longer than this period of time, I could imagine that this is that we have to come up with such limits at the moment until we understand them better.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I understand that octopuses are very intelligent, but I don't have qualms about eating them. So I just feel like, and also, I mean, just the idea that our consciousness is just in our brains only, as opposed to extending through our entire nervous system, also seems flawed. I don't know. But I get that you have to be sensitive. To me, sometimes I get frustrated at call it narrowish points of view that then are like, oh, we can't engage in scientific discovery processes that probably not engaging in has an implicit cost to society that is harder to quantify, but actually quite meaningful.
Yeah. No, I mean, we need to, I'm about interested in the enabling character of this technology. Yeah. But I also would like not to jeopardize this by losing ground and grounding to a general public. This has happened with genetically modified food, for example. This is not really a big safety concern, but it is a big concern for many people because it was never well communicated. It was always communicated only as the advantage for the industry. We can produce the food cheaper because we can make it insect resistant or whatever. Yeah, but it was never communicated as what is in the box for the consumer. What do I get now? Cheaper food, or something? Yeah, or do I get an additional health effect by putting something in? And because we missed this discussion, there's now, at least in Europe, tremendous resistance against genetically modified food.
It's been a fascinating discussion, Professor Hartung. Thank you so much for joining us. And I guess go grow 10,000 more brains this week, please. Organoids, brain organoids. Little.
We do. We have at least 11,000 questions for them.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.